obviously not the answer they had expected. "Excuse me?" the man said. "You heard me. Bullshit!" Rick got a cigarette lit, came a little closer, and blew a long plume of smoke directly in the man's face. Lyra couldn't have come up with the words herself, but in that moment, a strong web of feeling knitted together in her chest, and she came as close to loving him as she ever would. "Who sent you?" There was another short silence. When the man spoke again, his voice was harder, and Lyra felt the impact of the words like little metal hammer blows to the base of her spine. "You violated parole. You were caught with an illegal handgun. You assaulted a police officer. You jumped bail." "I didn't jump bail," Harless said. "They let me go." "Our records say you jumped bail. That makes you a fugitive." He drew out the syllables, stretching them taffy-like between his teeth and his tongue. Rick froze with his cigarette halfway to his mouth. Then, to her surprise, he started to laugh. But the noise was awful and reminded Lyra of the way Nurse Don't Even Think About It used to cough up phlegm when her allergies were bad. "Shit. He turned on me, didn't he? Fucking Ives, piece of shit. Well, it's my fault for trusting him. We need the kids, Mr. Harless. Where are they?" "Fucked if I know." He took another long drag and spoke with smoke ribboning out from the corners of his mouth. "You don't believe me?" "We don't want any trouble." "Neither do I, but it sure as shit seems to find me." He shook his head. The light was a lurid yellow, and in its glow he looked exhausted, washed out like an old photograph. "I don't know where they are, I'm telling you. The boy took off sometime last night, stole $1,000 out of a lockbox from the impound lot and made off with it. As far as I know, he hopped a plane to Mexico."
"With no ID?"
"You can buy IDs, same as you can buy anything else. Ain't nothing and no one in this world isn't for sale. But you know all about that, don't you?" He smiled narrowly, threw another mouthful of smoke. "Careful," the woman said. But Lyra could no longer follow their conversation or the shifting currents of insult and threat that eddied around their spoken words. Selim was gone. Selim had stolen money and run off. She knew both that it was impossible, he would never leave her, and that it was true. It explained why he had consented to the job in the first place, and the bed he hadn't disturbed last night, and why he still wasn't home. He had done what he did at Haven. He'd split. "And the girl?" the woman said. But at that moment, Tank, the fluffy white dog Angie Finch kept in Lot 34, started to yap, and Angie Finch's voice, thick with sleep, hushed him sharply. Something thinned on the air. Lyra had the impression of a drawstring cinched suddenly tight, squeezing out the possibility of escape. "Look, why don't you come with us? Get in the car. Come on and talk about it," the man said in that fake lullaby voice, the kind Dr. Good Morning used when he was knuckling new bruises until the pain sharpened to a kind of obliteration. "I ain't going nowhere with you," Rick said. His voice had changed, too, and Lyra heard the warning in it. He took a last drag of his cigarette, fanning his fingers, making a show of it. "Not unless you make me, and I can kick up a pretty big scene." He flicked the butt. Lyra watched it flash the distance between them, spinning through the web of old shrubbery. By bad luck, it landed on her foot, a half inch from the sandal strap that would have protected her. She swallowed a short cry, shuffling backward and disturbing a rustle of old leaves. Both strangers whipped around, and for a second, before she retreated farther into the shadows, she could swear that Rick's eyes landed on her. Or maybe he only sensed her presence. She sat there, sweating in the darkness, stomach cramping from an agony of fear. The woman took a step in her direction. "You hear that? Something moved back there."
"I wouldn't, if I were you."
Rick's voice was louder now and froze the woman before she could come any closer. Lyra could see now the woman's heavy jaw and penciled-in eyebrows, her hair showing its real color at the roots.
"Not if you like your fingers. Had a lot of problems with coons these last few weeks. Had to shoot one myself. Rabid."
Now she was sure he'd seen her. It was a lie.
They'd had no trouble with raccoons other than catching one rooting around in the garbage can one time they forgot to put the lid on overnight. Selim had chased it off by shouting. Angie Finch's dog was barking again. Angie's voice was muffled by the trailer walls. "Shut up, you filthy animal!" "Look," Rick said, "I don't know where they went. Like I told you, they could be halfway to Mexico. If you want to find them, you're wasting your time talking to me." The woman seized on this. "You think they're together?" Rick scowled. "I'm done talking," he said, as if they'd caught him out in some kind of lie. She understood it was all an act, a show, so they would leave, so Lyra would have a chance to escape. The strangers exchanged a look. The man cleared his throat.
"You know what I think?"
He didn't wait for Rick to answer.
"I think you're hiding something."
Rick said nothing. Lyra searched his face for the resemblance or the history he'd promised her was there, the story where she was a baby, loved, swaddled, wanted. But she couldn't find it. Still, for the first time ever, she had the urge to call him father. She wanted to tell him to run.
"We can help you," the woman said. "Get those charges in Florida dropped once and for all. Clear your record, even."
Rick appeared to be thinking about it. He gnawed the inside of his cheek.
"She isn't your baby girl anymore," the woman said softly. "It was a terrible thing that happened to her. Terrible. But all those kids raised out there on that island, they're all screwed up in the head. They're made all wrong. They're dangerous. You understand that, don't you? They're putting good people in danger."
"She would never hurt anybody," Rick said, but weakly, as if he wasn't totally convinced. And he was wrong, anyway. Several times in the past few weeks, Rick had walked her out behind Lot 40 where someone had pinned paper targets to a rotting fence and shown her how to shoot his gun. She had seen the guards aiming at water birds for target practice back at Haven and had even heard some of the other replicas boast about trying it out for themselves. Some of the male guards would let them do that, hold and fire guns for exchanges Lyra understood only distantly. Haven was, in a way, like a large-scale replica of the mines it had grown. Things needed to be neatly locked away, certain areas inaccessible, the whole place kept clean and bright and orderly so it could function at all. Rick told her she was a good shot. She liked to imagine Dr. Goodmorning's smile wrapped around the aluminum of a beer can. She tried to picture God pinned to her targets, but whenever she did, her hand faltered. He was cruel, and he had filled her with disease. He had done terrible things. But he was still her God.
"She doesn't have to want to. She's sick. She's got a bad sickness inside her. If word gets out..."
The woman shook her head. "Can you imagine the panic? Can you imagine the protests, the violence?" Rick stood there some more, acting out his uncertainty. Finally, he said,
"All right. All right, I'll come with you. But you gotta help me out, okay? I'm talking clean slate."
"That's a promise,"
the woman said, and the lie was like a long metal tongue, something smooth and slick and easy. When, Lyra wondered, did people learn to lie so often and so well? She wanted to scream, "Don't go!" But it was too late. He was getting into their car already. The woman got behind the wheel, and the man took the passenger seat. Just a few seconds, and they might as well never have been there at all. Headlights dazzled Lyra as the car reversed. She was seized by the sudden memory of lying flat on an observation table, disembodied voices and hands touching her. She could see her father's face, framed briefly in the car window, and the sweep his eyes made as they looked for her again in the darkness. A sudden panic overwhelmed her. Wrong, wrong, wrong! It was like the alarm that had gone off during the code black, except this time the sound was inside her, in her chest, shaking her lungs. She had barely thought about Jake Witz and how she and Selim had found him hanging from a door with a belt around his throat, but now she did. She saw Rick's face in place of Jake's, his skin a mottled purple and his eyes enormous with fluid. She had seen many corpses in her life, had watched countless replicas bundled and packaged onto the freight barge for disposal, but Jake's was different. Rick would die too, she knew that. That was what power was, to decide who lived and who didn't. Dad. The word rose in her chest and pushed the breath from her lungs with its weight. Dad. She thought of running after the car, rocketing out from the shadows and offering herself in his place. But she stayed where she was. The taillights dimmed and then disappeared, and the growl of the engine quieted to a purr, and finally became the soft tutting of the crickets, singing endlessly from 10,000 hidden places. Inside the trailer, everything looked the same way it always did. The warped mirror and the framed needlepoint, home is where the heart is, were in place. The TV was still on. An open can of soda had left rings on the old wood coffee table. And next to the sofa, the makeshift curtains were still drawn around Selim's mattress. He might have been sleeping. He might have been only moments from strolling through the door wearing a salvaged T-shirt and jeans that hung below his hip bones, showing off the muscles like wings above his waistband. She had traced those muscles with her fingers. She had licked them to know the taste. She wanted to scream, to break something. Now she understood the replicas who spent hours knocking their heads against the walls or who picked all the skin off their arms. Rick was gone. He was as good as dead, and it was her fault. Selim had left her. Was she still the same person without him? Who was she? Brandy Nicole? Lyra? 24? Someone or something else entirely? She touched her face, her breasts, her thighs. She didn't seem to have cracked anywhere. Nothing had broken off, and yet she felt that something had broken, that there was a big, gaping hole somewhere inside her and air blowing through it. She knelt on his sheets and put her face to his pillow. It smelled like him. She took the shoebox and carefully laid out the belongings he'd collected, placing them side by side on the mattress, as if they were runes, and by some magic she might call him back. The brochure from the Nashville Elvis Festival, bus schedule, a receipt, the plastic wrapper that had enclosed a utility knife, several miniature Snickers uneaten, old batteries. And then she blinked. And the objects blinked too and became something else, something meaningful, not trash, but a sentence written earnestly and urgently just for her. She smoothed out the receipt and read the list of things he had purchased from Able Hardware. One utility knife, one pocket knife, one flashlight and four packs of AA batteries, a butane lighter, a can opener. The bus schedule was from something called the Knoxville Transit Center. Her heart jumped. Someone had circled all the buses running between Knoxville and Nashville for Selim. Selim had left her, that was true. Probably like he'd said, he thought she didn't want him around. He thought she'd be better off without him. But he'd also left her clues, just in case, and they all pointed to Nashville, where another god named Elvis had made hundreds of replicas. Selim had gone home, and she was going home with him.
Gemma. 5. The Winston Able Mobile Home Park was just under 6 hours away, 40 minutes outside Knoxville. Pete and Gemma drove mostly in silence with the radio off and the windows down, except when Pete asked whether it would be all right to stop and get coffee. The drive, the tension, the wind blowing in the wake of passing semis and the windshield dazzling with headlights. It all felt like they'd tripped over a wrinkle in time and wound up back where they were 3 weeks ago. Gemma tried to sleep, but couldn't. Whenever they passed a cop on the road, she got jumpy. Gemma had told her mom she was going to sleep at April's house, and Pete had told his parents he was sleeping in one of the Ives' guest rooms. And April had, after much protestation, gone home so that she could run interference if Gemma's mom called the house before Gemma got back. April's moms had left the party early, so there was no reason to think her cover story had been blown so quickly. Still, if worse came to worse, Gemma hoped her mom would assume she had merely lied in order to sleep over at Pete's house, which Christina seemed to suspect Gemma was always angling to do, seemed to hope for it, But she knew, too, that anything was possible. Her dad might have gotten suspicious. He might have radioed friends in the Force, friends at the tolls, friends even now crawling dark highways, waiting to stop her and bring her home. A network of owed favors, backroom deals, contracts and alliances. The whole world was a spiderweb, and all the threads were made of money. Jeffrey was the spider, which made people like her and like Lyra and Selim the flies. It was just before 6 o'clock when they spotted a sign for Ronkowoa, a dump of a place whose claim to fame was one of Tennessee's largest privately owned plastics manufacturers. By then, the darkness was letting up a bit, but the air was smudgy with chemical smoke and had its own gritty texture. Gemma remembered that her dad's brother, Uncle Ted, had helped restructure the Knox County debt, but she was still surprised to see a strip mall containing a hair salon, a liquor store, a check-cashing place, and a local bank, sporting the name Ives. It made sense. The Ives brothers loved nothing so much as ownership. The trailer park was at the end of a long dirt road that badly needed paving. They went so slowly it felt as if they might simply be rolling in neutral. Gemma was itchy with anxiety, as if she were wearing a full-body wool sock. She saw no sign of Fortner, or whoever he had sent to do his business. There were no other cars on the road, no strangers lurking around in the early morning shadows. Then again, she knew there wouldn't be. People like Fortner worked fast and clean. Most of the time, at least. What if they were too late? She wished for the millionth time that Lyra had called her, and wondered for the millionth time why she hadn't. Gemma had told her to call first thing after their phone got set up, and had spent hours watching her cell phone, as if she could will it to ring through the pressure of her eyeballs. Despite the grid of dusty, dirt-rutted streets, none of the trailers seemed to be in numerical order. Gemma's father had said that they were in number 16. She assumed that the unnumbered trailer between lots 15 and 17 must be the one they were looking for. But then she spotted the plastic children's toys scattered in the patchy yard. This wasn't it. Couldn't be. Still, they got out of the car, moving slowly, quietly, so they wouldn't startle anyone. Gemma wasn't in the mood for a showdown about trespassing. And besides, it was possible that even now they were being watched. Spiders had 8 eyes, enough to see in all directions. But human spiders had hundreds, maybe thousands more. She was almost relieved to hear a dog barking. Everything until then had been so still, so silent. She might otherwise have thought they were too late, that the whole damn place had been rounded up. Gemma was turning to shush the dog when she saw movement from a dingy white trailer set behind a scrub of balding bushes across the street. A girl, or a boy, she couldn't tell from a distance, not in the half-light, slipped outside and turned to lock the door. As soon as the girl started down the stairs, Gemma knew her. "Lyra?" she said. Her voice sounded hoarse. It was the first time she'd spoken in hours. "That's Lyra." She and Pete jogged to catch up. Lyra was already moving away from them, head down, as if she was afraid of being followed. Did she know she was in danger? Where was Selim? She must have heard them approach, because suddenly Lyra whirled around, hands on her backpack straps, elbows out like miniature wings. "Lyra." Gemma felt out of breath, though they'd gone barely 100 feet. Lyra was more beautiful than she remembered. Funnily enough, she was wearing eye makeup. Not just a little, either. Shimmery, smoky, purple eye makeup. The kind April applied to Gemma when she was practicing her technique. She dyed her hair, too, a platinum blonde. She had gained badly needed weight. "What are you doing here?" Typically, Lyra didn't smile or even seem that surprised to see them. Despite having come to warn her, Gemma found at the last second she couldn't say the words. Couldn't admit to Lyra that everything her father had promised was a lie. Instead, it was Pete who spoke.
"You're in danger," he said. "The people who killed Jake Witz are tracking you and Selim. They're probably on their way now."
Lyra hardly even blinked. "I know," she said. They were here already. Gemma's heart fell through a hole. Is Selim gone? She frowned a little, as if the word carried an unexpected taste. The world tightened around them, even the air seized up, and grew too heavy to breathe. They got him? Lyra shook her head, a quick spastic movement, like an animal trying to shake off a fly. He was already gone. I saw them come, and I hid until they left. They'll be back, Gemma said. She could barely understand what Lyra meant. Selim gone, but not taken, and Lyra now alone? But she knew for sure they would come back. They'll be back any second. You have to come with us. I can't, Lyra said abruptly, and then, an afterthought. Thank you. I'll be careful. She turned and started walking again. For a second, Gemma was so stunned she could only stare after her. Then she registered the red backpack Lyra had on, bulging with belongings. Where was she going at just after 6 in the morning? Where had Selim gone? Wait, she called out. Lyra turned around, still with that same blank expression, a little bit patient, a tiny bit irritated, too. Unexpectedly, Gemma was furious. That was the good thing about anger. It was always bigger than fear, always bigger than guilt or disappointment. You could count on anger. What do you mean, you can't? And where's Selim? Pete was on Gemma's team again, bound to her by exhaustion and frustration. Where did he go? Home, Lyra said, as if that made any sense at all. I'm going after him. I don't think you understand, Gemma said. The long night was starting to catch up to her. Whenever she closed her eyes, she saw starburst colors, quick explosions in the dark. The people who came here won't just quit. They'll look until they find you, wherever you are. They're looking for Selim and me, she said. They won't expect us to split up, and they won't expect us to get far. They don't think we're smart enough. Her expression changed, just for an instant, like a plate shifting deep under sea and causing ripples at the surface. Besides, what other choice do we have? You could come with us, Gemma said, but she knew that Lyra had made her decision. Gemma was fumbling for a way to convince her, hauling at a line stretched thin to a breaking point. We could drive you somewhere far away, she said. Maine, the Oregon coast, Canada, wherever. Not without Selim, Lyra said simply. You'll never find him, Gemma argued. Do you know how many people there are in this country? Millions and millions. But there was no way to explain to Lyra how big the world was and how far it went. Until a few weeks ago, her world was by the water, by a fence that ringed her off into a few square miles. You just said the people who came from Haven will find us. That's different, Gemma said. They're bigger than we are. Do you understand that? They have cars. They have drones and money and friends everywhere. Lyra's face changed again. A new current swept away all the feeling, shutting her down to a perfect blank. You forget what they made us to be, though, she said, softly, gently, as if Gemma were the one who needed to understand. Gemma shook her head. Her heart was beating through her whole body. Every minute the sun leached away more cover. Invisible, Lyra said. So softly, Gemma almost missed it. Then she smiled. Gemma thought it was the first time she had ever seen Lyra smile, and the effect was dazzling, like watching the sun slide behind a prism and light it up in various colors. Thank you, though. I mean it. Please, Gemma said as Lyra turned away. Take this, at least. Gemma took her wallet from her back pocket. It was cheap, plastic, and covered in smiley faces, and April had bought it for her as a joke their sophomore year. There were probably $60 inside, plus an Amex tied to her parents' account, a debit card, a non-driver state ID, a folded-up note April had given her on their first day back in school after break. This note certifies I give zero fucks. And, In the little coin pouch, a nest of unspooling thread she'd picked off Pete's pocket the first time she'd worn his sweatshirt to school. She could get new cards, and even an ID wasn't that difficult, especially since she didn't drive. She had only a few $100 in her bank account anyway. She mostly regretted that bit of thread. "You'll need money. You know how to use an ATM card, right, to get money? The code's easy. 4411. Can you remember that?" "Thanks." Lyra managed to smile again. Then she did something funny. She reached up and placed two hands on Gemma's shoulders. "See you," she said. That was it. She turned and disappeared. At least, to Gemma, it seemed like she disappeared. Even though, of course, Lyra was actually visible for a while, moving between cars, heading in the direction of the highway, and finally passing into a thicket of disease-blighted trees. The sun had finally come up for good, and Gemma found her eyes watering in the sudden bright. She should run after Lyra. She should beg her, or scream at her, or force her to come with them. But she knew it wouldn't do any good, and she didn't move, and couldn't breathe. She knew they would never see each other again. Lyra would be cleaned up like Jake had been. Selim, too.
"Gemma?"
Pete found her hand and held it tight, tight, as if she was in danger of falling off a ledge.
"You tried, okay? You did everything you could do."
Gemma said nothing. It didn't matter if she'd tried. She'd failed. And that was the only thing that counted.
"You can't feel guilty about this, okay? You can't save her. You can't save any of them. I want you to say it."
She was surprised when Pete pulled her into a hug. His shirt still smelled a little like the tiki smoke, his skin like the sweet punch they'd been drinking. She felt like crying again, but she kissed his collarbone through his shirt and tilted her head to catch his Adam's apple, too. "I tried," she said. "I can't save them." As quickly as the urge to cry had come, it was gone. It wasn't that she believed it exactly, but that it didn't matter anymore. What she had said to Lyra was true. The people working against them were too big. They were too strong. Lyra and Selim would die by their will, just as Gemma had lived. The hand of misery that had been squeezing her for weeks unclenched. She felt light, free. She saw now that her only mistake had been in thinking she had a choice. There was evil everywhere in the world. Liars outnumbered truth-tellers, probably by 3-1. So what did it matter, one more or less? She might even be able to look at her father again. "Let's go home," she said. For the first time since they'd left the party, Pete smiled.
"Now you're talking," he said,
and kissed her hand even as he interlaced their fingers. He seemed happy. He thought she was happy. She didn't have the heart to tell him the truth. There was no need, anyway. Happiness never lasted, because happiness didn't pay dividends. That was just the way the world worked.
Lyra, 5. It didn't take her long to pack. There wasn't much she owned, and almost all of it had been owned by others first and would, she assumed, be owned by new people later. A bright pink sweatshirt, a pair of sneakers, and one pair of flip-flops, 3 t-shirts. Even the backpack Rick had purchased for her, red nylon and blotchy with old stains, was doodled over with someone else's notes and pictures, like a skin covered with faded tattoos. But she was careful to pack all the belongings she'd found, all the things she'd salvaged from the dirt. Pens, metal, soda tabs, loose coins. She debated whether to bring Rick's gun with her, in case the man and woman, suits even if they had been dressed casually, caught up. But after weighing it in her hand, the metal oily like a slick of pollution, she put it back. She was afraid not that she wouldn't be able to use it, but that she would. That she wouldn't be able to stop. Maybe, she thought, the strangers who'd taken Rick away were right. Maybe all the replicas were broken. Maybe they didn't have souls, like the nurses had always said. Maybe they were like the shells that Cassiopeia had sometimes collected, abandoned by whatever had once lived inside of them, full of nothing but a hollow rushing. But if Selim was broken, then she was broken in the same way, and she didn't know much, but she knew that had to count for something. She was eager to set out as soon as possible, but her body was heavy with exhaustion, and waves of dizziness kept tumbling her. She meant to close her eyes just for a minute to catch her breath, to get her strength back, but woke up hours later in a panic, just as the sun was poking through the sagging blinds. Dawn already. She shouldered her backpack and slipped outside, fiddling with the door handle, which was loose, to lock it. It gave her a brief pain to think of what would happen to the trailer with no one there to care for it. Soon she knew it would be reclaimed by squatters, and the other residents of Winston Abel would strip it of its good furniture and sheets and dishware. Or they would gray the walls with cigarette smoke and carpet the floor with a surface of broken bottles like in Lot 48, where people went to get drunk and worse. But she let this worry slip away from her, like a kind of smoke. She had learned long ago to let things go, to let them pass, to allow all her worry and hurt and need to simply drift, cloud-like, until it had left her behind. Tank was barking, as usual, as if he knew where she was heading and wanted to be sure she didn't get there. She turned in the direction of the highway. She would cross through the truck way station again and have to pass Eagle Tire. She hoped she wouldn't see Raina, but had no idea how long parties lasted. One time she had woken up at dawn after the Haven Christmas party to the sound of laughter and the crack of gunfire. A few doctors and some of the guards were taking turns hurling bottles and trying to shoot them in midair. She heard a familiar voice call her name, but knew she must be imagining it. Sometimes in her dreams she heard Dr. O'Donnell call her voice in just that way. Only the second time did she notice a sharpness to the voice that didn't sound like dream or memory, and didn't sound like Dr. O'Donnell either. She turned and saw Gemma and Pete. Gemma, flushed and pretty, was wearing clothes that struck her as exotic and reminded her of some of the birds that landed occasionally on Spruce Island, elaborately colored, sleek, showy. "What are you doing here?" Lyra asked them. She thought Gemma's house was far away, but she couldn't be sure. The journey from Florida to North Carolina, the meeting between Rick Harless and Gemma's parents, seeing parents up close, even, was a whole all of its own. She felt if she got too close to the edge, she might fall into a place that had no bottom. "You're in danger," Pete said. "The people who killed Jake Witz are tracking you in Selim. They're probably on their way now." "I know," Lyra said. She thought of Rick and the way his eyes had swept the dark for her trying to latch on. She thought of his pink scalp and his blunt fingers and his slow, shy smile, all of it soon to be reduced to nothing but skin cells and decomposition. A long rope of hatred coiled around her throat. They were here already. Gemma was sweating. "Is Selim?" "Gone." Lyra hated to hear the word out loud. It was like something rattling inside an empty tin can. Gemma closed her eyes and opened them slowly as if she was trying to pry herself out of a dream. They got him? He was already gone. She thought of telling Gemma and Pete where he had gone, that there might be others like them, free and living happily in Nashville, but she was afraid that they would discourage her, and that saying the words out loud would burst them like small bubbles and make her see how silly she was to hope. "I saw them come, and I hid until they left." "They'll be back. They'll be back any second. You have to come with us." "I can't," Lyra said. "Thank you. I'll be careful." She knew they were trying to help. Rick had taught her to say thank you like he taught her to say please, to look people directly in the eyes and say hello, too. She turned and started off again, but before she had gone 4 feet, Gemma called her back. "Wait." Gemma's face looked unexpectedly altered, her eyes startlingly bright, as if they'd grown. "What do you mean you can't? And where's Selim?" Pete's whole face was pinched with exhaustion as if someone had sewn his skin on too tight. "Where did he go?"
"Home," Lyra said, and ignored the way Gemma and Pete looked at each other. She knew they couldn't understand. The world had grown too big. She had to shrink it back to manageable size, back to the slender weight of the secrets that she and Selim could carry together. "I'm going after him."
"I don't think you understand."
Gemma was trying to be nice. Lyra knew that, but her voice was razor sharp, as if at any second it would fall off an edge into hard anger. The people who came here won't just quit. They'll look until they find you wherever you are. They're looking for Selim and me, she said. They won't expect us to split up, and they won't expect us to get far. They don't think we're smart enough. She thought of the way the nurses and doctors had always spoken over their heads, had avoided their eyes, had joked and laughed about things in the outside world, never understanding that Lyra had been listening, learning, absorbing. And it struck her as funny now. They hadn't thought to watch what they said because they believed they had complete power over her. But as a result, their power had become hers. She'd eaten just enough to survive. Besides, what other choice do we have? Lyra could tell that Gemma knew immediately that there were no other choices. Still, she said, you could come with us. We could drive you somewhere far away, Maine, the Oregon coast, Canada, wherever. Places that made Lyra feel uncertain again, places she'd never heard of. Not without Selim, she said. Selim was a person, but he was a place, too. He was her place. You'll never find him, Gemma said. Do you know how many people there are in this country? Millions and millions. Lyra knew her numbers up to the hundreds because there had been nearly 2,400 replicas at Haven, but she didn't know what millions was. You just said the people who came from Haven will find us. That's different. They're bigger than we are. Do you understand that? They have cars. They have drones and money and friends everywhere. Lyra was surprised to realize she felt sorry for Gemma. Gemma was so desperate to help, she didn't understand that Lyra and Selim were beyond reach. They belonged to a different world. You forget what they made us to be, though. Lyra spoke gently, and then, invisible. She managed to smile. Smiling had always felt strange, but now it was getting easier. Thank you, though. I mean it. Please, take this, at least. Gemma dug in her pocket and found a small wallet that was covered in a repeating yellow graphic of smiling faces. Lyra was momentarily breathless when Gemma handed it to her. It was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen or held. Its plastic, slick and new-feeling, bulky with whatever it contained. She wanted to smell it, to nibble on its edges. You'll need money. You know how to use an ATM card, right? To get money? The code's easy, 4411. Can you remember that? She nodded. She had had to remember numbers for cog testing, words, too, and parrot them back for the proctors. She knew now that they had been testing the progression of prion disease. But at the time, she had thought they only wanted to prove how smart the replicas had grown. She only wanted to do well. Thanks, she said. She couldn't bring herself to decline it. Already the plastic wallet had warmed in her hand, pulsing there as if it belonged. She took a step forward, overwhelmed by feeling, and before she could decide against it, brought her hands to Gemma's shoulders, the way Rick had for her. Gemma's face reminded her so much of Cassiopeia in that moment that she felt an unexpected doubling of her life before and after. She was two Lyras, and she was no one. She was a hole falling through the past. See you, she said, stepping quickly away because for a split second a terrible urge possessed her to hang on, to stay with her hands on Gemma's shoulders and never let go, an urge she thought she'd been rid of long ago. She turned away. She knew she'd never see them again. Let go. It was surprisingly difficult to walk, to keep walking, as if the air was throwing up extra resistance. But there was no other choice. Let go. It was the rule that bound everything, as true in the outside world as it had been in Haven. Let go. Let go. Let go. She thought of wind through the trees and laundered white sheets and the warm fog of anesthetic. Let go. She thought of clouds and shadows and waves. She thought of the ocean, bearing away a boat filled with the small bundled bodies of the dead.
Gemma,
6. They were only a few miles out from the dump of run-down fast food restaurants that counted for the center of Ronkawoa when they came across the accident. A big delivery truck and a sedan nosed together at a right angle, so they blocked the road entirely. The truck driver was visible in his cab, hunched over the phone. The woman was pacing, and when she spotted Pete and Gemma, she flagged them down, as if they might otherwise have any choice but to stop. "Don't get out," Gemma said when Pete unbuckled his seatbelt. "There must be another way home."
"She could be hurt," he said.
Gemma was too tired to care, and too tired to feel guilty. "She isn't hurt," she said. "She's walking, see?" And she was. The woman was heading straight for them, gesturing for Pete to roll down the window. When he did, she leaned down to squint into the car. She had the washed-out coloring of an old T-shirt, but her eyes were dark, and Gemma didn't especially like them. They were the kind of eyes that worked like specimen pins, as if they were trying to nail things down in their proper place. "Sorry to bug you," she said. "Do y'all have a cell phone I could borrow? Mine's out of batteries, and this guy won't give me his info, won't speak a word to me." Gemma's phone was also dead, so Pete handed his over. Gemma did feel a little guilty then. The woman's hands shook badly when she tried to dial the police, and it took her several tries before she could get the number right. She moved away from the car, plugging one ear with a finger, while the truck driver climbed out of his cab and glared at her. Gemma didn't like the look of him. He looked big and ropey and mean. The woman hadn't even hung up before the police were on the scene. Two of them, a man and a woman, who arrived in an unmarked sedan. Every minute it got hotter. Gemma and Pete sat and watched the woman and the truck driver argue, and the cops look on, impassively. They were too far to hear what was being said.
"Should I ask for my phone back?" Pete asked.
Gemma shook her head and said nothing. She was too tired to think. When he keyed on the engine so they could use the AC, the female cop turned in their direction as if seeing them for the first time.
"Great," Pete said.
Now it was the cop's turn to approach.
"Just great."
"Step out of the car, please," she said in the flat drawl of someone extremely bored with her job. Gemma could see the sky mirrored in the woman's sunglasses, and she straightened up as fear twinged her spine.
"Hang on a second," Pete said. "We didn't do anything."
"Please step out of the car." She showed her badge, a flash of gold, and then it retreated.
"But we didn't do anything," he insisted. "We were just driving home and we came across the accident."
"I understand. If you could both just step out of the car, we'll get you on your way in a minute." "Just do it," Gemma whispered to him. Now the other cop was sauntering over, hands on his belt, working a piece of gum in his mouth. They got out of the car. The backs of Gemma's thighs were slick with sweat from where they had stuck to the seat leather. It was bright and very quiet. A dozen cows stared dolefully at them from behind a rotting fence. From their perspective, Gemma and Pete were the ones fenced in.
"You see what happened?" the female cop asked.
Pete was getting agitated.
"No, I already told you we had nothing to do with it."
Now the male cop chimed in.
"You from around here, then?"
Pete hesitated. His eyes slid to Gemma's. Once again, she felt a pinch of worry. Could they be sure these were real cops? She'd only seen the woman's badge for a second. They weren't driving a squad car, and though they were in uniform, it wasn't like she could pick out a fake. Still, she knew they were safe so long as there were witnesses. "We're from Chapel Hill," Gemma said. Right away, she knew she'd made a tactical error. The male cop's eyebrows blew up to his hairline.
"You're quite a little ways from home," he said. "What you doing in Tennessee?"
"It isn't any of your business," Pete said.
Gemma nearly told him to calm down, but she didn't want to make things any worse. The cop gnawed his gum some more.
"You too got some ID?"
Gemma's heart sank. She didn't have ID. She'd given Lyra her wallet. Pete seemed as if he might argue the point, but at a look from Gemma, he turned and moved back to the car, muttering. Gemma waited in the agonizing silence, half wondering why the truck driver and the woman he'd smashed were being so patient. If she'd been in an accident, if the cops were wasting their time on two nobodies instead of helping, she would have lost her shit. But they just stood there, dumb and practically silent, as if the cops' arrival had turned them into statues. Pete was taking too long. He searched the front seat. He appeared to crouch as if searching the floor. When he straightened up, his face was hollowed out with fear.
I can't find my wallet, he said.
Gemma felt the ground buck like an animal beneath her. What do you mean?
What do you think I mean?
He threw open the door to the back seat and disappeared again.
I can't find it. It's gone.
That's impossible. But as Gemma closed her eyes, she remembered that they'd stopped for coffee a few hours before dawn. She saw Pete, juggling a styrofoam cup and a water bottle, slide his wallet on top of the car so he could reach for his keys. What if he'd left it there? They'd been so tired. It was possible. Pete slammed the door shut. Then suddenly he aimed a kick at the rear tires. Gemma shouted. The cops started toward him and he backed off, holding up both hands.
I'm all right, he said. I'm all right. Why don't you have a seat here on the curb?
The male cop reached for his belt. Gemma saw a flash of metal handcuffs.
What? Are you going to arrest me now? We didn't do anything. Settle down, son. No one's accusing you. No need to get so defensive. I'm not defensive. Early in the morning, wearing party clothes, maybe you've been drinking some, decided on a little joyride. Jesus Christ, this is insane. We weren't joyriding.
Pete, Gemma's voice cracked. Everything was happening too fast. Gemma felt as if she were listening to a song at triple, quadruple speed. There was a high ringing in her ears, like the sound of electricity through a live wire. Danger. Please. We weren't joyriding, and we haven't been drinking. We have friends nearby.
Friends?
Too late. Gemma knew she'd made another tactical error.
These friends have names?
Pete jumped in.
We don't have to tell you anything. You don't have any reason to hold us.
He was almost shouting. But for a second, the cops seemed to realize the truth of this and froze where they were.
Can I have my phone, please?
These words he directed at the female driver, the one who'd originally flagged them down. Funnily enough, however, she didn't move. She didn't even blink. Again, Gemma had the impression of a statue. No, not a statue. An actor. A bit part actor whose lines have come and gone, contentedly watching the rest of the play from the wings. Too late, Gemma understood. Too late, Gemma knew there were no witnesses, and no one to hear them scream.
Lyra, 6. Lyra knew from the bus schedule that Selim was heading to Knoxville, and from there to Nashville. She knew that Knoxville was a large city less than an hour away by car because that was where Raina's mom worked at a 24-hour restaurant called Big Tony's. But she didn't know how to get there. The first person she saw, a guy unloading cartons from a grocery truck, pointed her in the right direction and even offered her a ride. But she didn't like the way he looked at her. "Can't walk all the way to Knoxville," he'd called out when she kept going. The next person she asked, a woman counting change behind a gas station counter, told her she couldn't get to Knoxville without a car. But a third person had overheard the exchange and told Lyra outside that she thought there was a local bus station that had buses to Knoxville. She was black with very red lipstick and so tall the light haloed behind her as if she were cracking the sky with her head. She smelled like Dr. O'Donnell had, like lemon soap, very clean. Lyra thanked her and kept going. It was a 7-mile walk along a bleak industrial road that kept edging close to the interstate and then away again. Stanton Falls was bigger than Ronkawoa, but she didn't know by how much. She knew she was in town when she began to pass occasional strip malls of mostly shuttered stores. She saw a boat shop, too, funnily enough, since she had no idea where the nearest water was, with little motorboats displayed in the brown grass and covered with tarps. She couldn't have said what drew her across the yard and to the display, only perhaps that it reminded her of where she'd first met Selim, in an overgrown section of Spruce Island, littered with old waste. One of the tarps had been loosened and retied. She saw that right away. She tugged it free and knew that someone had slept there. On one of the benches, the treads of a dirty sneaker had left marks. There was a crumpled Snickers wrapper, too, wedged between two seat cushions. Probably Selim had arrived too early before the bus was running and had lain down to sleep for a bit. She was catching up. But in Knoxville, she lost hope again. Knoxville was by far the biggest place she'd ever been, full of so many people she couldn't understand how there was enough air to allow them to breathe. And the clamor of noise made the back of her teeth ache. Faces, faces everywhere, all of them looked the same to her. The Knoxville Transit Center was huge, all glass and concrete and escalators rolling up and down, the loudness and the lights and the womp, womp, womp of her own heart, like a fist punching her in the chest. A man shoved her, a woman yelled at her for standing motionless in front of the revolving doors, unsure of how they worked. There were people in lines as if waiting to get medication, and big machines grinding out slips of paper and numbers on big boards that blinked and changed, dozens of TVs, words everywhere, signs everywhere, the smell of sweat and perfume and bathrooms. She found a bus after twice standing in the wrong line and was handed a ticket and told by the girl who sold it to her that next time she could do it through the automated system, and also that she had cool hair. "I went short for a while, too," she said, "until my mom said she would boot me from the house." This gave Lyra a boost, however, as it always did when she went out into the world, into people, and passed. Because at heart, and despite what Raina or Rick thought, she knew the truth now. She wasn't one of them, and would never be. She had to wait because the bus wasn't ready to board. She counted how many people wore red hats and how many people wore black ones. She tried to close her ears to the unfamiliar voices, dozens of conversations that together sounded like the grinding work of one large machine, all stutters and beeps and sharp hysterical alarms. Whenever an individual voice reached her, she was reminded of how the researchers had spoken, moving in packs down the halls as if they were cabled together invisibly, using English, but somehow an English she didn't understand. A man sitting next to her on the bench picked dirt from his fingernails with a pen cap and spoke in words that made her head ache for their foreignness.
"Can't fault Walsh on that snap. You watch and see. Seattle'll blow holes in their defensive line."
Holes. She closed her eyes. She breathed carefully through her nose. She'd believed for a long time that the outside world might be as big as 10 times Haven, and after escaping she knew it had to be at least 10 times that. But a bigger vision was impossible. What she knew of Tennessee was Ronkawoa and the walk to the Target and back and the Winston-Abel Mobile Home Park and its grid of 62 lots. In the end, she only knew the bus had arrived when a loudspeaker voice announced that it was getting ready to leave, and she had to run to the far end of the terminal, barely gasping through the doors before they shut behind her with a hiss that sounded ominous. She lurched into a seat just as it began to move. The blur of landscape still made her dizzy. She leaned back, clutching the schedule she'd been given in one hand. It was already wet, damp with sweat. 3.5 hours to Nashville with one stop at Crossville to pick up new passengers. She got sick in the tiny, filthy bathroom once, twice, a third time, until nothing came up but bile. She couldn't rinse her mouth out. There was no water to drink. So she wiped her mouth with a sleeve, toweled off her face with a hem. An old woman seated near the bathroom shook her head and frowned, as if Lyra had gotten sick deliberately when Lyra made her way carefully back to her seat. But she felt better. She was even a little bit hungry. In Crossville, there was a layover of 20 minutes, and the passengers disembarked to use the bathrooms and buy food from the station. Lyra was feeling a little braver, so she showed the bank card Gemma had given her to a woman across the aisle. "I need money," she said, since Gemma had said that was what the card did.
The woman gave her a strange look. "Well, there's an ATM right over by the bathrooms," she said. Lyra shook her head to show she didn't know what that meant. The woman squinted, moved her gum around in her mouth. "It's your card, isn't it? You've got a code?" 4411, Lyra recited, and the woman put up her hands to cover her ears, laughing. "Whoa, whoa, whoa, you're not supposed to say it out loud." She put her hands down again, and her son thought it was a game, placed his hands to his ears and down again, and said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa," and cackled. "Please," Lyra said, getting desperate now. The bus would leave in 20 minutes. She was hungry, she had not had anything to eat in 24 hours, and the station smelled like frying meat fat, like the stew pot in Haven, but better. "I need money." The woman let out a shush of air, like the sound when Squeeze Me had finished hugging. "Come on, I'll help you." She took Lyra's arm, exactly where Squeeze Me would have in order to read her blood pressure. Her hair was gray and brown, both. Otherwise, she looked a little like Dr. O'Donnell. When they left Crossville, the bus was more crowded than ever, and Lyra's heart stopped when she saw that among the passengers was a replica like the kind she had seen in the Nashville Elvis Festival brochure, a slick of black hair and dark sunglasses, plus the same beautiful white jumpsuit with beading that caught the sun. She was desperate to ask him questions, but felt too shy. He was traveling with a large group and spent the whole time chattering with the other travelers or crooning along to songs the bus driver piped from the speakers. At one point he stood, staggering a little to keep his balance, and danced along to the music, pivoting his hips and holding a soda bottle like a microphone. Everyone laughed and even applauded, and Lyra felt a vague sense of foreboding. It wasn't real. It couldn't be. She was even more discouraged when the bus driver announced their arrival in Nashville. She had been hoping that Nashville would look like Haven, an orderly series of buildings contained by a fence. Instead, it turned out to be a city. Stack block buildings, signs puncturing the sky, roads like the serpentine trails left on the surface of the marshes by passing water snakes, the slow crawl of traffic, more people. Perhaps the world didn't end at all. Perhaps it went on and on forever. It occurred to her that if she didn't find Selim, she wasn't even sure how she'd get back to Winston-Abel, couldn't remember what bus line she had taken to Knoxville. But maybe it didn't matter. Now that she knew the people from Haven were looking for her at Winston-Abel, now that they had taken Rick away, she couldn't return anyway. She followed the line of passengers off the bus, trying to work up the courage to speak to the man in the clean white suit. He moved quickly with a surge of other travelers toward the station doors, and she knew that as soon as he hit the street, she risked losing him. She was sure that she would find Selim wherever the replicas were heading, and so she took a deep breath and jogged to catch up, with her backpack slamming against her lower spine and echoing the rhythm of her heart. She had to say please several times before he turned around. The people with him, regular people, none of them replicas, but none of them dressed as nurses or doctors either, turned with him. Under the weight of their stares, Lyra felt suddenly shy.
"What's the matter, little lady?"
he said. He had a deep voice that rumbled in his chest.
"You want an autograph or something?"
She knew what an autograph was. It was when a doctor put down his signature on a piece of paper. The nurses were always asking the doctors to autograph one thing or another, disposal orders, cognitive evaluations, the reports generated by the extraordinary kissable graph. This gave her confidence.
"No autograph," she said. "I'm looking for all the others."
"You're here for the festival, huh? You an Elvis fan?"
Raina had said that Elvis was the name of their god.
"I need to speak to him," she said, which made the others laugh.
"Isn't she sweet?"
one of them said, but another one frowned.
"I hope she ain't on her own. She's too young for it."
The replica with the dark hair inched his sunglasses down his nose.
"You want to talk to Elvis, do you?"
he asked, and she nodded.
"Come on. Let me show you something. Come on,"
he said, and gestured for her to follow him out the revolving door into the bright afternoon sunshine and the wet tongue heat. In the distance, she could hear the faint roar of a crowd, like the break of ocean waves and a cascade of music.
"You want to talk to Elvis, little lady? You just close your eyes and listen."
the male said.
You hear that? That's Elvis talking right there. You just gotta follow the music.
Gemma. 7. The worst thing about being kidnapped with your boyfriend